If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
May 16th is National Drawing Day, and you're saying, Karen, what does that have to do with the law? You have a legal show. Well, our next guest is a professional artist who has had a major impact on the way courtrooms and the players are depicted for years and years, for decades. Pat Lopez has been a court sketch artist. She has covered high-profile trials like the Kobe Bryant sexual assault case, Matthew Shepard murder case, Karen Silkwood, Waco, Susan Smith, Selena, Oklahoma City bombing. Pat, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you coming on Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to you.
Oh, thank you, Karen. I appreciate it. And thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here.
So I want to know, first of all, as a sketch artist, and you've been doing this a long, long time, who hires you? Who typically is the entity that hires you?
Well, it depends on the story. In the past 40 years, of course, I've sketched very high-profile cases for ABC News, CBS News, CNN, Associated Press, 60 Minutes, 2020, and various other newspapers and news stories, depending on how big the case is and who wants to, you know, get it out there.
Yeah. And so do they direct you and say, all right, Pat, I want you to focus on, you know, getting the defendant when he walks in, or the jury or the judge? Like, or is it up to you to kind of depict what you feel is going on in the courtroom that's important?
Well, that's a good question. And I work with the news producers and the reporters to understand what the focus of their story will have. I then go into the courtroom and I sit there with my paper and pencils ready to sketch, but I observe, completely observe, and I'm very careful about what I observe, where I observe, and who I depict until I know what the story would need, and then I start the drawing.
And do you start, let's just say that you're in the courtroom early, are you drawing the courtroom before so you have a little startup time so that when the players actually come in there you can sketch quickly?
I wish I could, but I don't do that. I've worked to develop my ability to capture a likeness of anything in a very short amount of time. And I think that helps me to understand that I don't have to be panicked, you know, if something happens differently from what I assumed would happen in the courtroom. For instance, if they bring out a different kind of evidence, a forensic picture, or they bring in a new witness instead of the ones that are on the list, then I'm ready. I'm ready to sketch them.
You know, our right to a public trial is really, really important. In fact, I was just reading a news story. In Utah, a judge decided to allow cameras in the courtroom for the trial of the man who was accused of killing Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk's lawyers did not want cameras in the courtroom. Utah has a pretty strong presumption that cameras in the courtroom should have them unless it's really going to impact the trial adversely. But do you sense that importance, that you're in a courtroom, it's supposed to be a public trial, you can't have millions of people in a courtroom, so you're going to bring what's in there to people who are interested in these high-profile cases. How do you feel about that, and how do you feel the weight of that?
Well, over the years, of course, I've been doing this for almost 40 years, the weight becomes less. It's more important that I sketch what I see as the truth of the moment in the courtroom. You know, I don't try to recreate any of the energy of the crime, obviously, but the energy is still there. When I'm there, I think I'm chosen in many cases because I do have a very good ability to capture a likeness in a short amount of time. I think that's why I was chosen on Kobe Bryant's case. They wanted to make sure that, you know, it was an exceptional look. So anyone watching the story would know who it was. I think that's happened on several other cases that I've done of luminaries, you know, like Martina Navratilova and Bill Clinton, and let's see, who are the others? David Crosby, of Crosby, Stills and Nash, that kind of thing. I think they would call on me because I could get a really good likeness of the person.
And I'm not going to disparage any other court sketch artist, but
no.
I have had a few cases that have been high profile, and I have some court sketches that I was able to purchase because there was a court sketch artist in the courtroom, and they sell their wares. And people come into my office, Pat, and they say, "Are you in this?" So actually, in the cases that I have, they did not get my likeness down too well. But you do.
I understand that. We all have different styles, of course. This genre of art takes to a great deal of, it leads you into a great deal of interpretation if you don't have a lot of time. But that's why I prepare myself. If I know that something's coming up, then I prepare and look at the likeness of the people who are involved and make sure that I know their faces and how they stand and how they hold themselves. But that's not often the case. So I do need to be right on the money when something happens and it is a luminary that we all know, you know, everyone knew who Kobe Bryant was. So I had to be ready to have his likeness down pat. I did not want to disparage anything in that case, especially, you know, his likeness, because I didn't know what the truth was. I just knew that I had to draw this man.
You had a funny story about him coming into the courtroom. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, well, during the process, I was the only artist allowed, and I think it's because I could get his likeness fairly well. Anyway, there were 45 satellite trucks outside of the courthouse, and every day the judge would allow me to go outside of the courtroom once I got my basic drawing down to complete it because I was working so fast and making a lot of noise with my pencils, I'm assuming. Anyway, I'd go outside of the courtroom and sit in the hallway while the cameras weren't allowed to come in. They had a runner at the door waiting to get my sketch so that they could shoot the picture. And every day when we went out at the same time, Kobe would always get up and take his bathroom break then. He'd come and stand next to me and watch me draw. And he was so kind and very complimentary. But I'm telling you, I complimented his shoes because he had an incredible amount of beautiful shoes to match every suit. And he said, "Well, of course, they're Italian."
And you asked him to sign one of your pieces.
I did. And he said, "I'm so sorry, miss, I can't." He said one of the downsides of fame is that my signature doesn't belong to me anymore, basically. And I thought that was sad.
He sold it away to Nike or someone. I don't know. When we come back, if you have any questions for Pat, 312-981-7200. And if you heard a case that we talked about that you would like to ask her about, that would be it would be very interesting. We're going to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing case and some of the other high-profile cases. And, Pat, where can people go to see some of your work? And if you have your stuff for purchase and all of that, where can they go?
They can go to www.sketchingjustice.com. Is that right? Let me look and see.
I think it's sketchingjustice-patlopez.com.
Right.
If you put her name in, if you just put court sketcher Pat Lopez, you're going to find her website very quickly.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
We're here talking to Pat Lopez. She is a professional sketch artist. She has worked in some of the highest profile cases in history for the last four decades. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the Oklahoma City bombing case. Can you tell our listeners the story about how you were hired to do it and how quickly it all happened?
Well, at 9:02 a.m., in Oklahoma City, and I think it was, I can't remember what the date was, May, the Alfred P. Murrah building went up in Oklahoma City, and when it did, dozens of cars were on fire around it, and more than 300 buildings around it were damaged or destroyed. Well, I was living in Dallas at the time, and my sister was in a bank across the street from the building, so I knew this was serious. CNN rushed me to the airport. Of course, all the airport was shut down in Oklahoma. But they hired a private jet, and I met with Tony Clark, and we took off to Oklahoma City. We landed, and the National Guard picked us up and put us into their jeeps. We rolled into the downtown. It was just quiet. You could imagine how quiet it was. There was no one else moving but us, and we were rolling over broken glass from the buildings that had fallen above. As we drove past the building where my sister was, I still did not know if she had survived. It wasn't until later that evening that I knew that she survived the bombing.
And so you covered the trial. Tell me about the experience of being in that courtroom. You know, you and I met at a crime convention, and we talk a little bit about the energy in a room, and you seem to be very, very attuned to energies and how, you know, and when you're involved in a case where all these hundreds of people were harmed, not let alone dead. Tell us what it was like to be in the courtroom in a case like this.
That was very difficult because Oklahoma City was where my parents lived, and it's where I first I first started my career in the building that was blown up, the Alfred P. Murrah building, and it was very difficult. I have learned to have a radar, of course, and I sort of block out everything when I go into the courtroom. I can feel if there's energy happening over here with a group of people or over there, the opposite, with a group of people. I can feel the energy, and I know what to look out for. So I have paper ready for it, and, of course, I oftentimes capture emotional moments because I'm ready, and I can do that in a heartbeat. It's just a matter of practice and doing it over and over again over the years.
You captured Timothy McVeigh, the defendant, who's since been executed. He was ultimately convicted of killing 168 people and injuring over 800. Just the magnitude is just astounding to even say those numbers. There was a moment that you captured. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that moment and why you thought it was something that you needed to depict?
Yes, it was one of the first hearings where he and Terry Nichols were in the building together because they were trying to separate their trials. And during that hearing, they showed a video of people being brought from the destroyed building, especially children brought out from the building. And in that moment, it was the first time that I think McVeigh had any kind of imagery that he hadn't been able to see anything on TV or because he'd been in jail. And he leaned forward to see the children being brought out on the video. And I noticed in that moment, that's what I was waiting for, that moment of emotional energy. The blood rushed to his ears, and I could see a vein pop out of his neck. And I caught that. I had him leaning forward on the desk, and I watched as his face held emotion for those children being brought out of the courtroom. However, from that moment forward, after that, I never saw any emotion in his face again. That was the one I was waiting for, and I got it.
What do you make of that? I mean, you know, you have to say to yourself that, you know, to do what he did was an astounding, horrific crime, and he had to have lack of compassion. Is he antisocial personality or whatever he is, or maybe he thought what he was doing was a positive thing. I don't know what was going on in his mind, but do you believe that there was compassion there? Do you think that what you caught there was compassion, or might it have been something else?
I don't know what it was, but I do know what I saw was the truth, and I'm there to draw the truth, and it's up to the viewer to accept that or not and determine what that was. I know that from the history we received from his mother and family members in court, he didn't grow up that way. He was a big brother and everyone's favorite kid on the block. So something changed, something turned, and it was after he came back from the war that this happened. So I have no idea. As you well know, I am now a behavioral health therapist, and I understand that things can happen inside of people. But in that moment, something was happening that touched him, something. I don't know what it was or how to define it, but I captured it with my pencils.
Now, when you before you go into a trial or a hearing, do you generally research what's going on? Do you look at what the charges are? Are you told what the charges are? Are you following it in the news? Or is it something that you just go in kind of cold turkey?
It depends on what it is. If it's an immediate something that happened that was just immediate, and this is the next day after the crime, then, of course, I'm going in cold. But if it's something that happened, you know, months before, and now they're finally coming to court, I've had time to research and discover, you know, what I need to know about who will be the character witnesses there, what I can look for, and what I need to watch out for in terms of maybe witnesses on the stand or in the courtroom.
And are you told ever not to sketch the jury?
Yes, quite often. And many times the federal judges in Texas, of course, knew my abilities well, and so they instructed me not to draw the jury because I could get some pretty good likenesses, and I didn't ever cross that line.
Now, you know, you're in the trial, and you obviously have a focus that's different than the attorneys, than the judge, than the jurors, than the witnesses, and the defendant. You have a very different focus. But do you ever look at the jury, and do you ever come up with, you know, an idea that this is going badly for the defendant, or they're not buying this, or do you ever make assessments as to how the jury is viewing the evidence?
Yes. And this is something that I think this is another factor that led me into the behavioral health career. body movements, how people hold their body, how they lean forward, whether the blood rushes to their ears, what grin or what kind of thing they may do with their facial muscles. It's interesting because everything that the person takes in, if it affects them emotionally, it shows up in your body, on your body, somehow, some way. And even how they dressed as the trial progressed, I could see who was likened to whom, I mean, who agreed with each other and who didn't. And I always knew if there was one on the jury that was fighting with everyone else because they always wore fire colors. It's fascinating, isn't it? But it's true. It's fascinating to know. And I never tried to ever, you know, of course, tell anyone this, but I did understand by what I saw from the jury as to whether or not this was going to be an easy verdict or a difficult one.
And this is a strange question, but I'm sure that you have been in courtrooms where there was jury selection going on. And as I've had on my show, many jury consultants who believe that they have really good ways of researching, whether it's social media or looking at body language or the way people answer the questions in the voir dire process, which is the jury selection process. But do you think that you would be helpful to a lawyer in picking a jury, given your sensitivity to the things you just mentioned?
Yes, probably. As a matter of fact, I've had many a defense lawyer come to me to ask me during the process, how do you think it's going and what do you think about our selections? Of course, I didn't respond because I didn't want to be a part of that process. That they're there to work for their defendant, you know, I took it as a compliment to my observatory powers that they understood that I knew something else was going on with this jury member or this potential jury member, and they wanted to know for sure and somehow, you know, underscore what they've chosen as being the right choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, observation is key when it comes to that, because a juror can say one thing, yes, I can be fair, but the body language maybe says something else altogether, right?
And body language and the clothing, by the way.
And the clothing. Tell me about the clothing. What is that? How do you interpret clothing?
Oh my goodness! For one thing, it would be the colors, the color scheme, which end of the color scale they're on, whether they're darks or lights or warm or cold, or whether they wear layers. Many women who don't want to be there will wear tons of layers, you know, sweaters, scarves, different layers of clothing. And as it goes along, if they've chosen to become a jury member, the layers will come off. And if they're fighting in during the process, the layers will go back on. Oh, it's fascinating. I need to write a book about that, actually. I think it's fascinating.
So if a juror is donned in, you know, black on black on black, what generally do you assess?
Well, that's funeral colors. So depending on what's going on in the courtroom, I can tell you that the jury member either wants it to be done or it's a dead issue. You know, you can go on and on and on. But definitely when they wear those colors, they've made up their mind.
Let's just give out your contact information. If anyone wants to look up Pat's work and some of the work she does as an art therapist, sketchingjustice-patlopez.com. Beautiful stuff. Court artist, you can email her at courtartist@sketchingjustice-patlopez.com. Can you hold on with us for another segment?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do that. And before we go, we've got just about 45 seconds before I have to take a break. But do you ever have any interactions with the judges and the judges saying to you, you know, Pat, you've got to make me look a little more handsome than I am?
Oh, yeah, they're always teasing me. And they do say things like that, but, you know, no one really, really means it. And oftentimes, after the fact, and this is after the fact, after the judgment has been given and the trial is over, judges will call me in because they want to purchase some work. And that's not common. But I don't say who they are or where it was.
It is, and you want that as a person who's handled a high profile case. It's nice to put that up in your office, and kind of look at it and remember that you handled something that was very, very important. You had a story about a drug case, a drug lord who really didn't want to be sketched. Can you tell our listeners about that one?
Oh yes, ma'am. This was in the 90s. I was in Dallas, and they brought in a drug case from Mexico. This was a Mexican drug lord. And they brought his team, his legal team, everything he had to protect himself, you know, into that federal courtroom. And it was a very high-profile, high-security case because of who he was. He had threatened almost everyone around him, so I was just another person. But I was in the courtroom sketching him. Apparently, after he saw my work, the next day, as I came in, he stared at me the entire time. He had earphones on because he could not understand English, and I was told through his interpreter, you should not sketch him. I just looked at him, and I'm thinking, well, I'm sorry, but this is my job. This is what I do.
That's a little intimidating.
It was. The judge, in fact, called me into his chambers during break and said, we're going to have you escorted to your car, to and from your car every day, and you will park in the judge's parking lot from now on. So I was very scared. I didn't realize the impact, but that's not usual, you know, to have that much. I've had a lot of people upset with me because I've sketched them. But this is different. My life was on the line.
The Selena trial, and gosh, that's been over 30 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, 1995. Selena was shot and killed by her manager. I think her name was Yolanda Saldivar or something. Saldivar, yeah. Now, tell us about that and what it, she claimed that it was an accident. She was convicted. What was your involvement in that, and what did you assess when you were in that courtroom?
Well, when I got the call to come into the trial, I was working for CBS News at that time. It's whoever calls first usually that gets me. I showed up at the courthouse, and I couldn't even park close, so I parked and walked about four blocks. And there were throngs of people outside of the courthouse trying to get into the courtroom for the trial. I finally got a hold of a producer, and she was able to have a police escort me in so I could get into the courthouse just to do the drawing. The whole trial was emotional. It was so emotional. It was filled with many, many people, and they were all very, very attached to the idea of Selena and her legacy. At that time, unfortunately, it was February or March of, in February of that year. Of course, this was in probably May or June, I think. In February of that year, my sister had been killed by accident. And I remember sitting on the same side of the courtroom as the family was sitting, and Selena's sister reached forward to me at one point and said, I want to thank you for sketching good likenesses of everyone here. My sister would be happy that you serve her. And I that was just, she gave me a hug, and that was really something.
Interesting. I'm going to talk about, too, it's hate to do this on Mother's Day, but you were involved in the Susan Smith case, and to remind our listeners, she was accused of killing her 1 and 3-year-olds by strapping them into a car and driving them into a lake. She claimed it was a carjacking at first, and then she backed that off. But what, you know, they were seeking the death penalty for her, and one of the top lawyers in the nation, David Bruck, who's an anti-death penalty lawyer and an excellent criminal defense lawyer, was her attorney. What do you recall about that case, and how that was received by the jury?
Well, everyone thought, of course, she was just going to, you know, go down really fast because it was a horrific crime. But David was very, very good at his job, and he brought in other experts to talk about what created, in Susan's mind, the reality for her life. And she was never someone who should have been a mother. She herself had been abused, and there was a lot of stuff that had happened in her life as a child that influenced her behaviors. And I think it was because of that that she was able to get the life sentence. David was very good at what he did, and so were his team. And I think that a lot of people, there was a lot of discourse in the community after that, but the jury stuck to their guns. There were a lot of women on the jury, and they understood, hey, wait a minute, you know, there's something here that influenced her, and that's not an excuse, and she should not be let off, but we don't believe it's all just something that she chose to do. Is something that happened because of her own abuse in life.
No, I had David on the show shortly afterwards, and he seemed to think that because her parents took the stand at some point, is my recollection. It's been a long time. And basically it was like, don't do this. We lost our grandchildren. We don't want to lose our daughter as well. And that was very impactful. I don't know if you recall that.
I do recall that, and it was impactful. And I saw many members of the jury, especially the women, it hit them hard. And I knew then that, you know, she'd probably get life because it was not something that, you know, they wanted to do. To repeat another trauma for this family.
Andrea Yates drowned 5 children in a bathtub?
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness.
What was that trial like?
That was really hard. Andrea had 2 trials, of course. The first one, they had to stop for various reasons, and they came back and retried her. She was not altogether there. She was on medications when she drowned those children, and there was all kinds of stuff that happened around her ability to even to be, you know, logical or she wasn't a mother. She was a machine and had to take all these medications in order to get up in the morning and just, you know, breathe. I think that was the most difficult thing to watch that. And I observe every little detail because that's my job. One day in court, now, she's always on medication, so she looks like she's on medication. She's sort of zoned out. But this particular day, something happened. They put up a picture of her little, the youngest that she drowned, and they had his clothing that he was wearing when he was in the tub attached to a board, and they put that up in front of her. All of a sudden, it was like the light went on inside, and she started screaming, and she was upset, and she was saying, oh, my God, that the evidence in front of her on the boards indicated that the child had died. And she, it was like she was first hearing this. I don't know. Her medicine wore off. Something happened. But the poor woman, she went through the trauma all over again. And that was very difficult. And it was hard for me to do a drawing after that, just to feel the energy in that room. It was very difficult.
What interesting stories you have. This is a book, and this is a book with pictures. I can see it coming, Pat.
Yes, it'll be called 13 Seconds, and I hope to have it by the end of the year.
So oh, I was just kidding. There is a real book. Well, I will be the first to buy it. SketchingJustice-PatLopez.com. If you want her contact information, you can always contact me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Pat, thank you so much for sharing all your very interesting stories with us here.